It's on, right? Thank you for waking up Saturday morning. And so I'll talk about Julia sets. So just a very brief crash course on Julia sets in general. So we'll only talk, you can define Julia sets for any map, and we'll only talk about quadratic, mostly talk about quadratic polynomials in this talk. So we let C to be some complex parameter, and we consider the mapping that takes Z to Z squared plus C, and which is the simplest kind of non-trivial polynomial mapping on the complex plane. The linear ones are not that interesting dynamically. And there are several ways to define the Julia set in this case. So one way is to say that the field Julia set is the set of initial point such that when you iterate from that point, the orbit does not escape to infinity, and then the Julia set is just the boundary of the field Julia set. So for example, since we know that the polynomial z squared plus c is equal to z has a solution, there is a fixed point that doesn't escape to infinity, which means the field Julia set is not empty. On the other hand, if you start with a number that's sufficiently large, when you square it and add some constant c, it becomes even larger, so things that are sufficiently far do escape to infinity. One of the benefits of studying Julia sets is that you get to draw pretty pictures. So let's see some examples. So this is an example of a Julia set with this parameter. So let's iterate some orbits. I hope you can see this dot. So we start with a dot that is inside the field Julia set, so we expect it to not to escape to infinity. Let's see what happens to it. So start iterating. It goes here, then here, and you can see that it stays around, and actually it converges to some three cycle here, and in fact there is a three cycle that's attracting, so that when you go around and compute the chain derivative, you get some number of absolute values smaller than one, so there is a geometric convergence. And actually, in fact, this is what happens to any point inside the field, in the interior of the field Julia set, so these years, for example, first get folded into this three and then get sucked in. So that's simple enough. Let's see what happens with this green dot. So the green dot is just outside the field Julia set, so we expect it to escape to infinity. And indeed, let's do the iteration. Goes here, then here, and here we can start to see that it actually escaped. This is the last dot you see on the screen, and then off it goes. So it's actually instructive to see them together. So if you notice, the red and the green dots started very close to each other, but their eventual trajectories are very different. So if let's look at them, they're really close, and as we iterate, you can still, for a while, you can still see that they started together, but they actually diverge from each other at an exponential rate, and eventually, of course, one escapes and the other converges. So another way to look at the Julia set is actually the set of points around which such an instability happens, that two completely different scenarios occur within zero distance, a distance that approaches to zero from each other. So let's see some more examples. So this is an example of a Julia set with empty interior. Actually, it has uncountably many it has uncountably many components, let's see what happens when you iterate a point. So now, all the point, the field Julia set is just the Julia set, and all other points escape to infinity. So let's see how this point, for example, escapes to infinity. So this is its orbit, and it escapes. Okay, so this is. One more thing that could happen. This is a very important example dynamically and also in the study of computational properties. So this is an example of a Julia set with a Ziegel disk. So let's see what will happen here. So we already saw an example like this that kind of looks like this. So what we expect is that points that start inside stay inside, perhaps converge into one of these components or first. And this is indeed what happens. So let's iterate this point. So it starts by going here and then here and here. And once it reaches this area, this is its orbit. So in fact, what happens is in this case that it obviously gets stuck in here, but the dynamic is not a convergence to one point, but rather a rotation by an irrational angle. So what happens is this: the orbit actually densely packs this topological circle within this disk. Well, this is it has to be a precise parameter, so it's actually there is a closed formula for the parameters for the parameter where it happens. So I mean, if you're not careful, then yes, but I mean, you have to choose precision. I mean, if you actually want to, well, here it didn't, so there was sufficient precision. It's not too bad. Eventually, of course, bad things will happen, but it's not a problem. And mathematically, of course, it doesn't happen because there is no error. So what happens here, actually, in a very precise sense that I'll talk about later, is that this the dynamics here is a rotation by some irrational angle theta. Okay. So, and we want to study computational properties of this object, of the field Julia set and the Julia set. So the basic problem is, given a parameter C as an input, we would like to compute either the field Julia set or the Julia set. And here, so one way to look at it is that the map in Z squared plus C is a dynamical system. The number C defines the rule, the world of this dynamical system. And then K sub C and J sub C are some, are natural objects within this within this system that we would like to study. Okay, so just one slide on an approach, a Blumshoff-Snell approach to this problem that it's a model of computation that uses precise arithmetic, and in that model, one of the statements is because Julia sets are not semi-algebraic, you don't get computability. But somehow it seems that Julia sets are inherently non-algebraic, and for that reason we need some other structure if we want to distinguish between different types of Julia sets. Let me talk about the computable analysis model of computation that we use, that is based on bit operations on Turing machines, which where we can actually we get a distinguishing power between different types of Julia sets. So we have a parameter C as an input, and we have our algorithm, and we would like to produce pictures of the Julia set as an output. So what does it mean? So first of all, there are two errors that we need to qualify here. We have the input and the output. And actually, there is one framework where you can discuss all of it, but let's just stick to this. Since we only care about one example in this talk, I'll just talk about this example. So the input is just a number, and it's given by an oracle, 5m, what it means that you're allowed to query C with any prescribed precision. So you can query, m is the number of bits of precision you want from C, and 5m is the output. So It doesn't matter whether phi of m comes from an input or from another algorithm. So, for example, if, I don't know, if C is pi, then phi of m would be an algorithm that computes pi. And then I say, compute, give me the first 500 digits of pi, it does it. You say, I want first 2,000 digits, it can do that as well. So it's allowed to query the phi of m, and it gets, so in this case, 1/4 approximation of the input. Then it can ask for another precision and for a higher precision, and it will get it, and so on. So that's actually the easy part, because here we are just dealing with numbers, so there's only so many ways, interesting ways to present a number. On the other end, we have some hairier object, which is a set in C or in R2. Here we have to be a little more careful. So the output is a 2 to the minus n approximation of the Julia set, where we are allowed to prescribe the precision parameter n with which we want to compute the set. And the approximation, I'll make it precise in a second, and the approximation is just a union of pixels. And for each pixel, we need to decide whether to put it on the screen or not. Right? So that's how you draw things. Yes, it's true. So
this definition kind of seems ad hoc, but actually it's quite robust. So there are five different ways you can define it that would be all equivalent. So in particular, mathematically, it's actually nicer to use round pixels instead of square pixels. So a pixel is just a circle of, say, radius 2 to the minus n. And the basic decision we need to make is either to draw it or not. So if the pixel intersects the set, our machine must color it black so that we actually see the entire set, so that we don't miss anything. If, say, twice the pixel is disjoint from the set, we must leave it blank so that we don't get things that are irrelevant. And in between, in a situation like this where the pixel is disjoint but twice the pixel intersects the set, we are allowed to do whatever we want. And the reason for this is that something that you want to avoid here is making sharp decisions. Because sharp decisions is something that for which you need infinite precision. But here somehow it's a decision that is only made with precision 2 to the minus n. And then the output, say, would be the union of all the black pixels in some sense. And this definition is equivalent to saying that you can compute the distance to the set, the function. Given a point, you can estimate the distance from that point to the set. It's equivalent to saying that you can approximate the set in the Hausdorff metric on compact set, among other things. The reason that we use this definition is actually for defining complexity, because complexity-wise, this is the right definition, as we'll see in the next slide. So far, we only talked about computing things, but we didn't have to pay. So now suppose that we also want to estimate the amount of computation required. So the time complexity is the worst case. So it depends on C, actually, and on the precision n. And we are usually interested in how this quantity grows with n, with the increase in the required precision. And it's the worst case time required to evaluate one of these pixels. Well, you're trying to understand where it is. Yes.
Right. So, I mean, of course, you cannot make decisions unless you know where it is, right?
Yes, but you know the parameter C, and you do some calculation, you decide
in this area, is there a piece of the Julia set or not? This is what, I mean, so far, this is exactly what you do when you write a program to draw pictures of Julia sets, right? So that's just formalizing it.
So you look at these balls and you iterate them and you decide whether they intersect the Julia set or not.
Well, this is, you're already talking about the solution. So I'm just describing the problem.
So what is the problem?
The problem is to decide whether this ball intersects the Julia set. One way to do it is by iterating it and seeing if it escapes or not. There might be other ways of doing this. Okay. Let me freeze this.
Is there any algorithm for if you're giving two complex numbers with an or cooperation to tell whether one is in the Julia set of the other, or maybe in the interior of the Julia set of the other?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So actually, I'll talk about it in a few slides. So the answer is no, but it's actually it's a very good question. So I want to say why this TCN is the right way to account for costs. So suppose you want to draw a portion of the Julia set on 1,000 by 1,000 screen. So in reality, that's not how you do it, but one way to do it is just decide each pixel individually, and then it costs you some constant, 1,000,000 times the cost of deciding an individual pixel. And when you zoom in, you only pay for the pixels you see on the screen. So, because the alternative would be to try to produce a Hausdorff approximation of size 2 to the minus n for the entire set, but then that quantity would usually be dominated by the exponential factor of just, you know, talking about all the pixels on this 2 to the 2n matrix of pixels. Okay, so far so good. We have a model of computation, and the question is which Julia sets can be computed and how efficiently. So,
I'm sorry to interrupt again, but I still don't understand. So, what does that question mean when Julia sets can be computed? What's the definition of it? Maybe it's containing what you just said, but I don't know.
So the definition is for which Julia sets we can produce, do we have an efficient algorithm for drawing them, for computing them.
So the key there is efficient then?
Well, efficient, I mean, is algorithm.
What?
Existence of an algorithm.
Oh, the key is just existence of an algorithm.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So for which Julia sets can you in theory compute?
Yes.
Just the existence of an algorithm.
Yes. So first of all, really, okay, so what would be the best thing we would hope for is actually...
Excuse me, that's a bit sort of... So the question is, for which C can be computed S of Qn?
Yes. So really, the first thing we would hope for is actually to take C as the parameter, and also take the pixel as the parameter and decide that. And actually, this is something that we can stop hoping for very quickly, because in this model, so something that I don't have time to talk about is there is a general fact that if you want something to be, if you have a set over which something is computable, it has to vary continuously. And in this case, if you want to be computing the Julia set over a set of parameters of differences, then it has to be the function that takes now the point C, the parameter C to the Julia set has to be continuous in the Hausdorff metric, And in fact, it's not. So this is one, maybe too fancy example of where it happens around the point C equal to 1/4. So at the point C equal to 1/4, the Julia set is this boundary, and around it you have all sorts of interesting behavior happening. KC, yes, of course. Actually, KC is somehow even worse, because KC here on the at 1/4 looks like this, and if you just move a little bit, the interior implodes, and you get like the picture like the one, the first one we saw, where with the totally disconnected set. So this means, in a more formal language, that there is no hope for having an algorithm that just takes C as the parameter and the pixel as the parameter and tells us whether and produces the Julia set. The dimension, probably, but yeah. We are even interested just in the set, not in the yes. Yeah. So here is a summary of the results. I'll talk about some of them in more details, but this is just should be comforting that there is a summary. So we need to talk to be able to have an intelligent conversation about these questions. We first need to talk a little more about the different types of Julia sets. So the first thing we can do to classify them is to ask the following question: does zero escape to infinity? And actually, if it does escape to infinity, you get a disconnected set, and if it doesn't, then the Julia set is connected, and it's actually exactly how the Mandelbrot set is defined. The Mandelbrot set is the set of C's for which the Julia set is connected. Okay, so this is another benefit of giving a talk about Julia sets, that you get to draw a nice big picture of the Mandelbrot set, and this is what's happening. So inside the Mandelbrot set and on the boundary, you have a connected Julia set, and outside you have a disconnected one. Now, the next question is whether the dynamics is hyperbolic. In other words, whether the local dynamics around the Julia set is an exponential expansion, and as we saw was the case in the first example where we started with the red and the green dot very close to each other and very quickly they diverge. So if it is the case, then all the points outside the Julia set converge to an attracting orbit, to an orbit with the derivative less than one. So we saw that this was the case in this example. Points inside converge to a three cycle, and points outside converge to infinity, which is actually a super attracting point, because convergence near infinity actually happens at the quadratic rate. And on the other hand, and also all the disconnected ones, since all the points that start outside escape to infinity, it's also true, because again, infinity is a super attracting point. And then there are all these other cases where this is not the case. For example, with the Ziegel disk, it's not the case, because instead of converging somewhere, you just keep rotating on this circle. And the Mandelbrot set, the outside points outside the hyperbolic correspond to hyperbolic disconnected Julia set. And as far as we know, all these black components inside are all hyperbolic components corresponding to different different shapes of Julia set. It's a major open problem to say that this is the case. In fact, that there are no components that are not accounted for by a classification of hyperbolic Julia set. And somehow empirically, the hyperbolic case is the easiest one to compute, and most pictures of Julia sets, most programs do really well on them, and there are also programs that do provably well. And the basic
One basic algorithm is the distance estimator, which basically the procedure is as follows. You iterate, you want to estimate the distance from a point to the Julia set. This is what we, drawing the pixels is estimating the distance within a multiplicative error of a factor of 2. So to do this, you iterate the point until the distance, and we know that it escapes at an exponential rate. So at some, so after linearly many steps, the distance from your point to the Julia set will actually be some constant. You will be able to measure it, and then you use derivatives to estimate the original distance within the multiplicative factor. And they were also formally shown to be computable by Zhang, and where it's for some cases actually there was a formal proof for polynomial time computability, and actually it's possible to extend it for all hyperbolic Julia sets by just going for it's nothing more than just formally analyzing the distance estimator algorithm and showing that it formally works. So the interesting, so life becomes interesting in, but life becomes interesting in this case when the Julia set is connected but not hyperbolic. And then actually there is one more question that we can ask, whether the Julia set has empty interior. So in other words, this KC is equal to JC. And here be dragons, so there are different things that can happen here. But in the case where it's not, when it's not equal, there are only two possible scenarios. One is when the dynamics is parabolic, so there is still an expansion, but it's just at a much lower rate. And so 1/4, C equal to 1/4 is an example of that happening. And the other is Ziegel disk, where we saw that also there is an area that doesn't escape to infinity, but for a peculiar reason of that it becomes a rotation, not because anything converges anywhere. So one interesting special subcase of the K sub C equal to J sub C is where the Ziegel where is Cramer Julia set, and that happens. So it's not true that for any rotation angle you can have a Ziegel disk. So for some irrational rotation angle, the Ziegel disk actually disappears. And here is the best picture of a Cramer Julia set that we have. So there are no useful pictures of it. So so this is a one pixel approximation of what it looks like. And there is a pretty good understanding of when it happens, for which parameter set that happens. I'll talk about it more towards the end of the lecture, but no useful pictures. So returning to our map, parabolic parameters live on this next between the hyperbolic components, and Ziegel and Cramer live elsewhere on the boundaries of the hyperbolic components. So for the parabolic case, you can just take the distance estimator algorithm. It still works. The downside is that it takes exponential time, because it takes exponential time to escape the neighborhood of the set. Once you escape, you of course can measure the distance, but it could take a while. And actually, on the other hand, what is exponential? Exponential means that it's exponential in n. So if you want to produce pixels of size 2 to the minus n, it will take time exponential in n. But if you want to produce only pixels of size 1 over 10,000, it means that it takes time on the order of 10,000. So it's still, if you just want to draw an entire set, and it's actually still maybe very practical to do so. So for Ziegel disk, for good parameters, you can produce pictures for empirically there are good pictures, and for Julia sets with empty interior, in some cases it's people can produce pictures, and in others it's hard. So on the positive side, we have the following results. So first of all, if the field Julia set is empty, then you can compute you can compute the Julia set. So it means that we actually have an algorithm for Cramer Julia sets. The downside is that we have no estimates on how well it works, and in fact, it works very poorly in terms of complexity, which means that it would take forever to run it. But formally, the obstacle to computing Cramer Julia sets is complexity. It's not an inherent non-computability problem. And another surprising result is for parabolic Julia sets that, in fact, those are polytime computable, and you achieve this by mixing some numerical and symbolic computation. And if I have time, which probably I won't, then I'll talk about this algorithm in a couple of in a few slides at the end of the talk. Okay. On the other hand, on the negative side, there are non-computable Julia sets in the Siegel case, which is, if you were paying attention, if you follow the logic, this is the only case left actually that we haven't covered in the positive side. So in the case of Julia sets with a Siegel disk, there are Julia sets that are not computable, and also you can extend this to show that you can produce Siegel disks that are computable but take as much time as you want to compute. And in fact, this parameter is, we can construct an explicit computable parameter for which computing the Julia set is as hard as the Hausdorff problem. So we can write an algorithm that produces a parameter such that if you can compute the Julia set, you have to solve the Hausdorff problem, which is of course impossible, and hence the Julia set J sub C is not computable. And another surprising kind of given, it's not surprising by its own, but it's surprising given this, is that the field Julia set is always computable. So no matter, even for in this case, if you fill in the Julia set, there is an algorithm to compute it, which is kind of similar to the algorithm for, it's another twist on the algorithm for computing Julia sets with empty interior. Okay, so here is, so I want to talk a little bit about proving the negative result. So here is the negative result in the picture. There is an algorithm A that produces a parameter C such that no machine can produce the corresponding Julia set. And this is, of course, not the corresponding Julia set. It's, we don't know what's the corresponding, we don't have a picture for it. Okay, so this is what we want, and the first step is to somehow massage the problem a little bit to make it easier to talk about. So first of all, I already told you that we will talk about Siegel disk, and it's equivalent, talking about the parameter C is just very, very easily computationally equivalent to talking about the rotation angle of the dynamics of the Siegel disk. So might as well talk about the angle theta, so because there are just simple formulas from going from C to theta. It's just C is something like e to the 2 pi theta minus e to the 2 pi theta square over 4. Some explicit simple formula. So might as well talk about theta and forget about C altogether. And the next step is to talk about something else instead of the Julia set, because sets are complicated, and we want so we'd be rather talking about something simpler. And in fact, what we would want to talk about is the size of this Siegel disk. So if you go back to the dynamical picture, this was our, I just cut out the Siegel disk from the slides in the beginning of the talk. So if you look at the dynamics on this Siegel disk, if you just take the Riemann mapping that takes an actual unit disk to the Siegel disk, then it's exactly it, it, it is it just simply is a rotation by an angle theta here. So if we iterate the dynamics, then here we get a rotation by the angle theta that fills the circle, and here we get a mapping that fills the image of this circle, because it just is the rotation up to this Riemann mapping change of coordinates. And when we do the mapping, the size, the conformal radius of this Weigel disk is just the derivative at zero, which measures kind of it's the right size notion in complex analysis for this simply connected set. And it actually turns out that computing the Julia, the only obstacle to computing the Julia set is computing the conformal radius of the Weigel disk. So obviously, well, not obviously, but if you have a picture of the Julia set, you can kind of do some calculations and compute the conformal radius of the disk. And vice versa, if you know the conformal radius of the disk, it turns out that you can compute pictures of the Julia set. So, in other words, this R of theta is computationally equivalent to the Julia set. So let's forget about the Julia set. So now we have a number here and a number here. So we are in a slightly better shape. One thing that is a little disturbing, that this quantity somehow seems very algebraic. It describes some quadratic mapping, whereas this quantity is geometric. It tells us something about the geometry of the Julia set. And to connect them, you actually need heavy tools that I'll talk about in the next slide. So this is actually the change of parameters that we use. We consider quadratic maps of this form. So this quadratic map, as you can see, have a neutral fixed point at zero, and locally around zero it behaves like a rotation by an angle theta, because around zero this square is negligible, so it becomes a rotation by an angle theta, and for which theta is there a Weigel disk. So the result about this was this question was answered by Bruno in 65, is when this function converges. So what it means is that so when theta is a rational number, you have a parabolic Julia set and the conformal radius is zero. So we are only talking about irrational points here. And points for which there is a Weigel disk are exactly points which don't look too much like rational numbers on too many scales. So the best candidate for something that does have a Weigel disk is theta, which is the golden ratio. So so it's like the number that is least worst approximated by rationals. Yes. So I'll talk about the okay. So the theta sub i's are so. Theta 1 is just theta, and the next theta sub i's are, so theta sub i's are, if you take, so actually, so if this is the continued fraction expansion, theta sub I is starting from, is cutting the first I steps in this sequence, okay? And theta sub I become huge if you see a huge, so theta sub I, one over theta n becomes huge if you see a huge number in the conformal fraction expansion, which means that at some scale your number looks a lot like a rational number. And if that happens a lot of the time, this sum actually might diverge, in which case your Weigel disk will disappear and you'll have a Kramer point. And you can see that the growth rate of this theta has to be astronomical in order for this to happen, which explains why it's so hard to deal with pictures of Kramer Julia set.
And in fact, the connection between this function and the conformal radius is much tighter than that. And in the paper, Buff and Sherita showed that this sum is continuous, so that this function phi estimates the conformal radius continuously. So morally, the previous result was just is a special case where phi is infinite, so r has to be zero. Yes.
Just a quick comment. Bruno's theorem was only one digression. That's a sufficient condition. Shows that this is a sufficient condition.
For the existence.
Jokic's theorem, which of course it shows that it's actually necessary.
So it's so this result, and then shows that it's a refinement. So it kind of what it says that the bigger phi is, the smaller the radius. So the and phi, the nice thing about phi is it's already a fairly algebraic object. It talks about continued fractions. It's something that we can handle. In particular, you can show that if you were interested in phi instead of r, you can generate, just from an algebraic construction, you can generate states for which computing the function phi of state is as hard as computing as solving the Hamiltonian problem. So this is the connection, and the connection between phi and r is continuous. If only we could refine continuous to computable here, we would be done. By just showing that there is no Turing machine that, given theta, computes phi of theta, we would also show that you can compute r of theta, because it would be computationally equivalent. Unfortunately, we don't have this, but we conjecture that it's actually true, that phi of theta is computable if and only if r of theta is computable, and that there is an algorithm to go back and forth between them. But nonetheless, the continuity is enough to finish the proof. The idea here is that in the key idea in the non-computability proof is that we can change r of theta by any amount while changing theta by another arbitrarily small amount. And the order of quantifiers here is crucial. You first specify by how much you're willing to change theta, and no matter by how much this quantity, how small this quantity is, we can drop r of theta by any other amount. So by changing theta by 2 to the minus million, we can alter r by 1/3, for example. And so here is how it works in pictures. So this is just the shorthand for the continuous fraction expansion. So we start with something that has 1, 1, 20, 1, 1, 1. So this is the Ziegle disk, and the value of theta is roughly 0.51. Now we start changing, we change the sixth digit in the continued fraction expansion. And we change, it starts with 1, and we can change it for into whatever we want. Note that because it's the sixth digit, it doesn't matter how big n would be, it can only increase the final theta by something like 1 over 10,000. Because it's, even if you put infinity here, it's just like changing this number from 3 to 1. So it doesn't change life that whole lot. On the other hand, it should change the conformal radius a lot, right? Because in particular, if you make n tend to infinity, the disk should disappear altogether. So the radius will drop from some obviously positive number to something that is small. And here is how it happens in pictures. So this is the Ziegle disk for n equal 1. This is what you get when you plug in 10. You see that you start seeing that the disk tends to be smaller. This is 100, 1,000, 10,000, and then you run out of steam when trying to compute this thing. So, but you already see that there is a clear pattern here, and actually is that the thing you can drop the conformal radius by any amount that you want. Yes, but conformal radius only it cares about things that you can reach with a random walk from zero. So whatever, it doesn't see the boundary, it gets stuck here. It would never pass. So, okay. So the definition, you have a simply connected set. Yeah, but the conformal radius is defined for any simply connected set. It's just you take the Riemann map from the actual round disk to the set, and you measure its derivative at zero. So, for example, for another disk, the conformal radius is just the radius, because the map would be a multiplication by the radius.
More or less, the largest distance you can fit in around
zero. Actually, yeah, that's yeah, it's true. It's true. But actually, this wouldn't be sharp enough for this proof, but it's true. So any drop is possible, and it's not just that we can drop it to zero, we can drop it by any amount that we want. We can control the size of the drop, which is important. So here is just the animation again, since it was so much effort to make it. Okay. So a summary. So from just taking this study and of computability of Julia sets and doing it formally, so in some of the cases we just reconfirmed what was believed in before. So for example, in the hyperbolic case, it is polytime computable. In other cases, the results are somewhat surprising. So the fact that the Ziegel disks turned out to be the bad guys, it's somewhat surprising, because in practice, in many cases, you are able to compute them. And on the other hand, given these two results, given the fact that for the parabolics, there is a much better algorithm, but it's not obvious, and that for Kramer points, there are no useful pictures, but we know that they are computable, means that there is a lot that can be done, that probably there is more that you can do in the Kramer case, and that in some of these questions, our intuition from just trying, the fact that we tried and failed by itself doesn't mean that something is hard. It might mean that we haven't tried hard enough or in the right direction. So one more result that I wanted to mention is the fact that topological hardness seems to be decoupled from computational hardness. So in particular, there is a topological property of the Julia set that classifies the Julia sets of local connectivity, which is that it's just a standard local connectivity definition. And it turns out that we can produce a number C for which the Julia set is locally connected. So the topological, being topologically simple, doesn't imply that you're computationally simple. And in fact, this is the table of topological simplicity versus computational simplicity. So here we have computable versus non-computable, locally connected versus not locally connected. So all the nice hyperbolic cases fall into this square. You have computables that are not locally connected. You have non-computable but locally connected, and you have so there is no you have all the combinations pretty much. Well, so there is no direct link between one and the other. So which means that, in particular, that computability is an independent classifier for that shatters. Beans Julia sets differently from other simplicity types of criteria. Okay, so one more point is that something that is somewhat atypical, if you work with these computability questions is that a lot of the time, if you have something that could be easy, it's kind of the Murphy law of computation. If you have something that might be easy or might be hard, and then you'd expect that the typical object would be hard. So I don't know, if you take try to factor products of two primes, then we don't expect an algorithm that would succeed 99% of the time. But here somehow, if you look at computability of Julia sets, non-computability is actually the exotic animal here. So outside, if you look at the Mandelbrot set, first of all these black components correspond to hyperbolic points and are computable, polytime computable in fact. The outside is polytime computable. Even on the boundary, most of the points are polytime, not polytime, are computable. Most Julia sets corresponding to boundary points are computable. In fact, we conjecture that the other dimension of all the C's for which you have non-computability is zero. So how much time do I have?
We have another 2 minutes.
So, all right.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. It's, you know, it's, there is this advice that when you teach in the last 10 minutes of your class, you should never say next time, even if it's in a completely different context, because people will just escape the room. So let me just give you the idea for the parabolic for the parabolic case. So we'll just concentrate on this specific mapping that takes z to z squared plus c. It's actually a very simple change of coordinates from z is taken to z squared plus 1/4, and we want to iterate a point to see if the trajectory escapes, and then maybe apply some distance estimator to it. So let me show you what's the problem. So suppose that z null is 2 to the minus n. So 2 to the minus n, it's obviously it escapes to infinity, right? Because it's a positive number, you add another positive number and then another positive number, that is at least 2 to the minus 2n. So it escapes. And we need to see that it escapes in order to be able to classify that point in time that is polynomial in n. So logarithmic in z. So let's try to do it. So the thing that you usually do is you start iterating. So z1 would be 2 to the minus n plus 2 to the minus 2n. Then something that is almost twice that, 3 times that, and after 2 to the n steps will actually succeed. But life is too short, so we don't want to do that. So this is a dramatization of the before picture. So this is brand X. It escapes slowly. So what we want to do instead is, so what we actually do instead to accelerate this computation is a symbolic, is do the computation symbolically, and we are lucky because in the parabolic case we are given the polynomial precisely. It's given in terms of rational numbers, which means that we can just do a symbolic computation. So the first iteration is z plus z squared. The second iteration is given by this polynomial. At some point we start chopping tails, but there is a clear pattern here. So it's always z. If you want the kth iteration plus kz squared plus something z cubed, and the something is actually a quadratic polynomial, and then a cubic polynomial in k, and so on. And this polynomial is something that we can write pretty quickly. And then it turns out that if you want to compute f2 to the n of z now, it's enough to compute n of these terms, it's enough to compute n of these terms and then plug in k equals 2 to the n, and then in one shot, you propel yourself 2 to the n steps forward. So, and actually it turns out that exactly because it's parabolic, this convergence is good enough around zero for that to happen, because you can see that k, you always have k to the power l minus 1 times z to the power l, so as long as z beats k, we are in great shape. So what you realize is savings when you are near zero, it escapes quicker, and then it's actually, after, if you are not in a small neighborhood, you just should use simple iterations, but
outside of the neighborhood of zero, actually, life, we are fine. There is an exponential rate of repellence, so we are good. And now the talk is really over. Thank you.